The good book tells us to take dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, and the livestock, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. But what the good book does not tell us is how to take dominion. And so today we pause to ask, is it possible to take dominion over the animals we are to eat in ways that satisfy the ethics of all?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1027th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Ez who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Jason, I have a question for you.
Go ahead.
Is it possible to take dominion over the animals we are to eat in ways that satisfy you?
Well, as a vegetarian, I should say nope, not at all.
Nope, not at all. Also with us today, a special guest co-host, Dr. Kelsey Olson. Kelsey, welcome aboard.
Well, good morning and thank you.
Now, let me ask you, do you think it's possible to take dominion over the animals we are to eat and raise them ethically to satisfy you?
I believe so, and it'd sure help me if we could because I had about a pound of treats over breakfast this morning, so you know where this is going.
Okay, we have a vegetarian and a non-vegetarian, and one says not going to work and the other says it will work.
We have the spectrum covered.
We have the spectrum covered today. Well, and we do have the spectrum covered, folks. In the book of Genesis, where things begin, we are told to take dominion over the fish of the sea, the birds of the heavens, the livestock, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. But we are not told how to take dominion. Throughout our history on earth, how to take dominion was never much of an issue. We were hungry. They were food. We took and ate. And that was that. But when we moved into the city and consigned our dominion over livestock to those left behind in the country, during the process of learning how to live in the city, we city people kind of pretty much forgot about the issues involved in taking dominions over the animals we were to eat. Not to worry. Someone always comes along with details of how animals are being treated by those to whom we have consigned our dominion taking. And when we learn the details, we are shocked. Yes, shocked. By how the animals are being treated out there. And so we city dwellers wonder about the ethics of those to whom we have consigned dominion over the animals we are to eat. We want them to be ethical in their treatment of animals. And that means? Well, what the heck does that mean to be ethical in treating animals? Is it possible to take dominion in ways that satisfy the ethics of all? Here to help us cook up some answers, we have Rebecca Thistlethwaite, who is the author of The New Livestock Farmer. Rebecca, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, where are you? You're up there in Oregon.
Yeah, I'm near Hood River, Oregon.
Oh, beautiful country.
Yeah.
Now, you are the author of The New Livestock Farmer. So one day you were walking along and decided to become an author of The New Livestock Farmer. What was your epiphany there, Rebecca? Have you always been a livestock farmer?
You know, my husband and I had a livestock farm actually nearby where you live, just south of Santa Cruz, for about 6 years. We sold meat and eggs, mostly at direct markets, like farmers markets. And we always felt like there wasn't very good information on the business side of farming and direct marketing meat. So after we left California, we decided to embark on a little trip around the country and meet some of the most progressive, sustainable farmers around the country. And we learned a great deal from them in addition to our own experience. And that was really the impetus for writing this book, to capture all that great information and make it available to other wannabe farmers or farmers who are already in business but struggling to make things more profitable and more sustainable.
Well, good for you for doing that. That's quite a service to provide humanity. But before that, before you met your husband way back when, Mm-hmm. You were a vegetarian, weren't you?
I was, yeah.
So there was I'm looking for the epiphany here, Rebecca. I know there was one someplace along the line. One moment you were a vegetarian and something happened.
Yeah, you know, for me, the most important turning point was seeing that there were more and more producers raising livestock humanely and on pasture. I was never against the idea of consuming animal flesh because I believe humans are omnivores and we should continue to be omnivores. But I was struggling to find meat that satisfied my values, and it became more and more available, like in the early 2000s, meat that was raised organically and on pasture and, you know, lived a good life up until the very last moment. So that was what made the switch for me. As a person with an ecological background, mm-hmm. I understand that animals are a really important part of the landscape, and I believe they should still be part of that landscape. So.
And you married a vegetarian.
Yeah, he was a vegetarian too, till he started raising animals as
Do
well.
Do you think there's hope for Jason? our engineer? Maybe
you
not.
Marry a rancher.
Yeah, there you go. So you a vegetarian, you met a vegetarian, you married a vegetarian, and somehow you both made this transition to livestock. What was the first step in making that transition, I guess, back to being an omnivore from being a vegetarian?
Well, it all started with the chicken.
It wasn't a 12-step program.
As in many things, it started with a chicken, and we started raising laying hens for eggs. And then, you know, with laying hens, eventually they stop producing, so you have to do something with them.
What do you do with laying hens that stop producing?
We sold them to other people who ate them, and we actually processed some of our own and ate them ourselves mm-hmm. and made stock from them. So that was sort of the first step. And then we added meat chickens, which are different breeds, and started raising and selling them, and people just raved about the quality of the meat. That's why we called our farm TLC Ranch, for Taste Like Chicken, because everybody freaked out that they actually really taste like chicken.
Well, wait a minute. Now, what's the difference?
Oh, a lot of people said that the chicken they get in the store is so pumped up full of salt solution, or it's just flavorless. And we had chickens that tasted like their grandmothers used to raise, mm-hmm. you know, like the old-timey flavor, because we raised our chickens on grass. So it gives them a different fat profile, and they taste differently. And then from there, we added pigs, we added cattle, we added a small flock of sheep, and, you know, as they say, it was a downward slope.
And what happens when you went to the vegetarian gathering and people looked at you as being heretics, I guess, now, right?
Well, we probably lost a few friends, but surprisingly, we converted a lot of vegetarians, especially selling into Santa Cruz, as you're probably well aware. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of vegetarians there, and they would sneak up to our stall at the farmer's market and whisper to us, "Do you have any bacon?"
Yeah, the ultimate corrupter, bacon,
yeah,
right?
And then the rest was history. You know, once they tried our bacon, they could never go back.
Uh-huh. And at what point then did you decide to really take on this issue then and write your book? I mean, it's a huge transition from being a farmer to being an author.
Yeah, well, I actually wrote another book called Farms with a Future that was a beginning farming guide, and a lot of that was based on our trip around the country. And I started speaking at conferences, and I would always fall back on livestock in terms of what I taught about. And I continued to have people attending my workshops saying, you know, there's not a book about the business side of livestock production, and you really should consider writing one. So I got enough people asking me for it that I decided to take the plunge and bring my husband down with me. So he wrote the first half of the book, which are all chapters on the raising side of animals. So there's a chapter on pigs, there's a chapter on poultry, sheep, cattle, exotics like bison and rabbits. And then I wrote the second half of the book, which really focuses on how to get your animals slaughtered properly, butchered properly, packaged, cold storage, labeled, and marketed. So
there's a lot of processes to talk about. But what we want to talk about when we get back from this break is a little something in the title of your book that caught my attention. It says, The New Livestock Farmer. When we get back, I'd like to ask you, Rebecca Thistlethwaite, what happened to the old livestock farmer? This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. We're looking at the ethics of growing meat. Well, how do we treat our animals? Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
Houseplants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking a little bit about what's eating what with respect to how we raise our animals. In the good book, it tells us that we are take dominion over our animals. And in that taking dominion, we're supposed to rule the world, I guess. But they don't tell us how to take dominion, and that's what we're talking about today, is how on earth we do that. And we have with us Rebecca Thistlethwaite, who is the author of The New Livestock Farmer. And something caught my attention in the title of her book, The New Livestock Farmer, The Business of Raising and Selling Ethical Meat. What heck happened to the old livestock farmer, Rebecca?
Yeah, you know, the term new kind of refers to a new way of looking at animal production, using the concept of a triple bottom line. So taking care of the economic side of things, so making money is a strong emphasis of this book. Taking care of the environment, which we depend upon to raise healthy animals, and also being socially responsible, you know, kind to your employees and to your community. So the old way of livestock production didn't necessarily have all three of those things going for it.
When you say old, what does old mean to you, Rebecca?
Well, I'm not talking old, but probably the last 100 years, where farmers have increasingly become serfs for the large meat packing plants. Mm-hmm. And really don't have any control over the pricing structure. And in a lot of cases, they earn less than it costs them to produce the animal.
The reason I ask, I guess, because when I hear the term old farmer, I think of my grandparents and the farm I was raised on up in Montana. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those, I guess the only place you could find a farm like that these days would be in the Amish community. Mm-hmm. And I think about the animals that we raised on that farm. And it seemed like every animal, every living thing on that farm had the responsibility of feeding every other living thing on that farm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a incredible relationship of everything feeding everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing was left out of the loop. But that's not quite the old farmer that you're thinking about. You're thinking about the industrial model that grew out of that form of agriculture, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But there are a lot of concepts in this book of going back to that old way. So we refer a lot to multi-species grazing, so you're actually raising all different forms of livestock together, which is probably how your grandparents used to do it.
Absolutely. So, it was a circus.
If you have dairy cows, you always have pigs, for example, so that if you have any waste milk, it's going to feed another animal. Or, you know, you have chickens following behind cattle to clean up their manure. I mean, it's a very integrated system, and yeah, it is an older way, but it's new again.
Okay, so what I think of the old way, you're thinking of as the new way, and
yes.
Everything in the middle then is what we're trying to avoid in this discussion.
Yeah, exactly. The movement to the factories and the consolidation in the meatpacking industry is what I want to help mm-hmm. people get away from.
Well, do you think it's that factory... Before we go there, Kelsey Olson had a great question about all of those animals being raised together. Kelsey?
Well, I'm fascinated by the idea of grazing animals together. I think that, you know, when you look at a farm, you see that movement as kind of the first, you know, form of vertical integration. But my question is, do different species require different treatment to live happy lives? I mean, a pig is different than a chicken, I know that, but you seem to move them all through the same kind of process together, one after the other. Do the chickens want something different than the pigs?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of synergies between the species, and then there's some, you know, competition as well. Like, we tried raising sheep, for example, with our poultry, and they broke into the chicken shelters to get the chicken feed, and we only wanted the sheep grazing the grass, not eating our really expensive chicken feed. So yeah. we quickly learned some lessons about setting up electric fence between animal species. So it's not necessarily that they're all in the field at the same exact time, but in a lot of cases, it's called a leader-follower system. So maybe you start off with cattle who kind of knock the grass down, and then you follow with chickens to break up the manure paddies, and then maybe you follow with sheep after that or pigs after that, so that they're not trying to eat each other's feed. Yeah, it can be challenging.
Well, I'd like to go back with this notion of dominion, because, mm-hmm. You know, the good book tells us we are to take dominion over our livestock and all over everything. And I wondered about the term dominion. Temple Grandin, when she was on the Food Chain, offered up a very precise meaning for what she thought it meant. She said responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I wholeheartedly agree. I think it's it is a responsibility. It's not necessarily a right. It's a responsibility. It's a privilege, really, to be able to raise animals, to have this relationship with them. It can be, you know, a lot of fun and also very sad when you see them go or you send them to slaughter. So it is an important relationship, and it's also one of the reasons we chose to raise animals as opposed to vegetables, because it's a little bit more, there is more of a relationship than there is with a radish, for example. But yeah, it can be quite enjoyable, and helping them lead an enjoyable life. We say they have one bad day in their life, but really it's like they only have 30 seconds in their life that mm-hmm. that are bad, and that's it. And that's how it should be.
And there you go. And it when you take responsibility, what does that mean with respect to how you oversee the lives of the animals on your farm when you become responsible?
Oh, well, I mean, it can keep you up 24/7. It can prevent you from going on vacation ever, but you just, you have to check on your animals daily. You should always, you know, look at them a couple times a day to check on their health and see if they're acting differently. You have to have a lot of, you know, observational skills and, just always being available and present for your animals and making sure that they seem happy and they're eating and they're doing well. And yeah.
So that sounds like a lot of work. And so when most of us, almost all of us, moved into the city, we mm-hmm. said, oh, the heck with all of that. Well, let's consign that dominion to Rebecca
mm-hmm.
and let her take care of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll forget all about what it means to, you know, be responsible for all of those animals. We just, the heck with it, you figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then that we're not paying attention, we go to finding the easiest possible way to grow the most meat for the least cost, right?
Yeah, yeah, it's true.
And so we end up, you know, when I look at factory farm agriculture, I see an exact reflection of us in the city.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a bizarre notion? I mean, you look at all of those animals crammed into pens eating bad food, and it looks just like living in the city.
Yeah. I mean, the way that we treat our earth, the way that we treat our animals is exactly how we treat each other. I think Gandhi had a quote similar to that. And the fact that we can allow our animals to be grown basically, you know, behind closed doors, for the most part, you know, the majority of our animals now are raised in barns. So we don't have
just to like it. Us, right?
Yeah, yeah, just like we spend most of our time indoors as well. So we don't have to see the horrors, essentially, that are happening behind closed doors, and then we can happily munch on our, you know, bacon cheeseburgers later on without understanding or caring or knowing about what's happening.
Oh, but we do know, and what we do know, we'll talk about when we get right back. Do stay tuned. Well, there was a way of growing and taking care of animals that existed for like 15,000 years or however long we've been taking care of animals. And then we all moved into the city and turned our back on what it took to raise animals. And we just forgot about it. We asked those who we left behind and consigned our responsibility, our dominion over the animal kingdom. You guys take care of this. We're moving into town. So we moved into town, quit paying attention. We worked on our smartphones and our social media and forgot all about what it took to raise animals. And then somebody comes along and says, wow, look what they're doing to animals out there in the country. It's terrible. It's terrible. Well, Rebecca Thistlethwaite, what is terrible about the way they're doing things out there in the country in those big, huge factory farms?
You know, I think that animals should live out as natural of a life as possible, so they get to exhibit their natural behaviors, like poultry get to take dust baths and scratch and peck, and pigs get to root or make nests, cattle get to eat grass or lie in the shade and ruminate, you know. And if animals are kept in cages or dark barns where the ammonia levels are super high and they're often on concrete floors, they don't get to exhibit really any of their natural behaviors. In a lot of cases, they actually go crazy. They nibble on each other's tails. They get very aggressive. That's not a good life. It affects the meat quality, which affects the food we eat, and it also concentrates the manure so that it is a pollution problem. So all the way around, yes, it provides cheap meat, but in every other way, it's really detrimental, I believe, to society, and it's not even good for rural communities. So if more of us started small pastured farms, it would create sort of a revival in our rural areas.
Well, let me ask you this, Rebecca. If it would revive our rural landscape and mm-hmm. revive our animal agriculture, would it not also have an impact on those of us who are living in the city and living in conditions that, for all intents and purposes, pretty much mimic living in a factory farm of some kind. You know, you just talked about pigs nibbling on each other's tails, and mm-hmm. you look at human behavior that, you know, of those of us who are stuck in cities and eating the foods that we eat and living on concrete and all of mm-hmm. that. Do you think having those small farms accessible would change us as well?
I think to some degree, if we see animals outside again and we sort of reconnect with our food source again to a larger extent, I think it will humanize us more. And I think there will also be more people wanting to move back to the country if they see a form of agriculture that they believe in and they can be connected to. I mean, not very many of us can go and build, you know, $5 million pig barns, for example. And so it's allowing our food system to be increasingly controlled by large corporations because it's really out of touch with what family farmers can do these days anymore. So I think that you would see more people connecting with their food source, maybe wanting to move out to the country, and then also just eating healthier food. Mm-hmm. I think you've demonstrated in a lot of your radio programs how it affects our behavior. And there is scientific data that shows, you know, that the quality of our food affects our behavior. And we, you know, maybe we'll kill each other less or we'll be less, you know, depressed and crazy because we're eating more nutrient-dense food.
I also wonder about the whole notion of our abdication of responsibility, mm-hmm. of our consigning, you know, the dominion of over the animal kingdom to somebody else, and then just running away from the responsibility, and you know, coming to the realization somewhere down the line, oh my goodness, they're treating animals poorly. Mm-hmm. It seems like some of that responsibility for the way animals are treated out there in the country should belong on our shoulders as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's why about 6 or 7 years ago I started a blog called Honest Meat, because I wanted to reconnect consumers and city dwellers with the ways that animals are being raised, not only, you know, the negative ways, but also share stories of positive ways of agriculture and just educate people about the nuances and, you know, that abdication and that giving away of responsibility. I think you see that in all, you know, all facets of our lives, of our modern lives these days. You know, we don't build our houses anymore. We don't know where our water comes from. We don't know where our food comes from. We're just increasingly distant from, you know, our basic living these days. And I think it leads to all kinds of problems, from mental problems to not knowing how to fix our problems or not caring. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Well, we are getting pretty good with smartphones.
I would argue that you could maybe call them dumb phones.
Dumb phones. Kelsey, you have a question?
Oh yeah, Rebecca, I was curious. When you talk about raising animals responsibly, I believe there's just an incredible amount of accountability that comes into the equation. Like, you know, you're really owning the situation. You are bringing it all into your lap and putting it all on your shoulders by making sure that these animals do get to live a natural life and do get to exhibit the behaviors that they would, you know, if they were not on a farm. But my question is, when you do raise these animals responsibly, does that responsibility lead to affection for the animals? And then if so, does that present a moral dilemma when the time comes to, you know, butcher the animal?
Yeah, or in the words of the 4-H people, don't name your animal.
Yeah, no Wilbur's.
Yeah, a friend of mine recently got a couple of butcher pigs, and she named one of them Party and the other one Freezer. So one of them she roasted up for a party, and then the other one's going into a freezer. But honestly, I take that back. More recently, we have named a couple animals because we're raising fewer of them, and it's more of a homestead situation now. But in the past, when we were doing it commercially, we never named any of our animals. Although we were very affectionate, especially with our sows and our boars, gave them lots of ear scratches, and really providing affection, especially to your breeding stock, is really important because you want them to be safe to work around. And we also had a young daughter, and we wanted her to be safe on the farm. So being kind to your animals means, you know, they'll be kinder to you. So it's smart.
So it really does go back to that model of my grandparents, wherein all of the everything on the farm, every living thing, everything, every plant, every animal, every person was responsible for feeding every other thing. And in doing so, everybody was happy when nobody was left out of the equation. We're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to pursue the notion of what it takes to actually farm the new way, as they say, which is really the old way and not the middle way or the factory farmed way. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Rebecca Thistlethwaite, and you do stay tuned. Right back. What do you think out there? Is it possible to raise animals in ways that will please the ethics of all? I wonder about that, because I believe there are those out there who simply do not want to see us raising animals at all. Was going to have a guest along that lines today, but she didn't show up. So I'll ask Rebecca Thistlethwaite the question. You were a vegetarian at one time in your life, Rebecca. Looking back to that time, do you think there would have been any way to raise animals that would have pleased you at the time?
Yeah, if I had known more about, you know, grass-fed producers and just understood animal agriculture better, I think I would have eaten meat. But I started when I was 16, and I was very impressionable and sort of naive about our food system. But I've increasingly come to understand the role of livestock, especially as it pertains to managing our grasslands, and the importance for livestock on small farms for their economic viability. So there's more and more reasons now that I have come to understand the importance of animals. And if we're going to have animals, we have to do something with them. I don't think we can have sanctuaries for animals. And
that's kind of what I've been thinking, you know, in considering this issue of dominion. Because there are those, I am certain, who simply do not want us to be eating animals. I think they have a philosophical notion that we should not eat animals, and that's that. And therefore, what do we do with animals if we don't eat them? I think of my grandparents' farm, where we had all of these relationships in which everything was feeding everything. What would happen if you don't eat the animals?
Well, I mean, it's kind of funny and strange, but if all of our domesticated livestock were just to today go to an animal sanctuary, they'd eventually die, and then that would be it for many of these breeds. They would be done, you know, because they, if we don't allow them to reproduce, they would no longer exist.
Not only do we allow them to reproduce, but we encourage them and give direction to that reproduction. And if we were to no longer take dominion over the animal kingdom, you know, I just wonder what would happen. Would the cows wander the street like they do in India?
Yeah, and to me, that's also just incredibly wasteful of our natural resources to allow these domesticated creatures, you know, to live on sanctuaries and continue to eat feed and hay and produce meat and milk and not consume it. I mean, that's just valuable protein that humanity needs. Where will it come from instead?
And soybeans.
That's a huge argument, or can of worms that we don't need to open, but, you know, that protein and that fat has to come from somewhere. Is it going to come from canola and soy that, you know, used to be rainforest? Like, you have to consider where those things come from.
Mm-hmm. And how they're made. And so there's ethics involved in our dominion over the plant kingdom as well as mm-hmm. the animal kingdom, then that nobody's yeah. really talking about that as much as yeah. they are animals. And a couple shows ago, we did a program on plant sex, and one of the questions was, do plants enjoy sex? And I guess if you're a vegetarian, that might cause some confusion in the issue then, probably. So let me ask you this. Let me pursue the go back to the notion of factory farm agriculture, because, mm-hmm. you know, most of us live crammed in cities and in situations that are just so much like a factory farm when it gets right down to it. Mm-hmm. Little apartments, walking on cement all the time, mm-hmm. eating dead food or food that mm-hmm. has been packaged and shipped in and, you know, reconstituted, and so there's really not much life left in it, and it's just kind of like those factory farm agricultures that we, you know, pretend to hate so much. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of doing that kind of agriculture ethically? I mean, would it be possible? That's something that Temple Grandin, you know, kind of addressed and said we can do this. Do you think it's possible?
Yeah, I mean, there are many who argue that we have to have meat production and egg and milk production on that sort of scale in order to feed the world. I would argue, you know, we need to have more than 2% of our population feeding the rest of us. So if we did get people back out onto the land, in particular back onto the giant grain farms in the Midwest and transition them back to how they used to be, which was you raise grain and pasture and livestock in a rotation, I think that would, we could still produce a considerable amount of meat and animal products just on a lot of smaller farms rather than, you know, a handful of super large farms. But I do think that there's positive developments happening in large-scale agriculture. You know, more and more poultry operations are going antibiotic-free. You know, there's increasing discussion about hormones given to beef cattle. And, you know, China, for example, won't take any beef that has been fed hormones.
Now, there's a class act, right? China?
Yeah. China's telling us to get rid of the hormones in our beef.
I love that.
Yeah, well, but, you know, that's having reverberations throughout the industry, and so eventually maybe American beef won't have hormones in it anymore.
There we go. And then we would, yeah. Folks, we're going to have to take our quick last break, but when we come back, we're going to ask Rebecca how to go forward in an ethical way that would suit most everybody, maybe not everybody, but most everybody. Do stay tuned. Right back. Well, you know, we have a life of leisure, those of us who live in the city. We can kick back and watch television and talk on our smartphones and do social media and go to the store and get food or to the fast food place and get a bacon double cheeseburger and not have to even think about where that food comes from or how it was processed and brought to us. And yet, there is responsibility in that, I think. And I think one of the greatest tragedies of modern times was taking people off the land and putting them into the city where they really don't have much to do when it gets right down to it. Were they back on the farm, they would have lots to do. Is that a fair thing to say, Rebecca?
Yeah, you never get a good night's sleep on a farm, particularly an animal farm. But it's also just incredibly rewarding producing animals that are happy, taking care of the land, and also just delighting customers with mm-hmm. really amazing meat, you know, that meat that they often haven't ever tasted before, so...
You know, some time ago, I was in South Dakota, and I was lost, wandering around looking for something, and I ended up at a dairy farm, and I pulled into the lot, and just got out of my car and was standing there waiting for somebody to come and give me some directions, and this young man came walking out of the dairy barn. He had big boots on, and obviously had been working with the animals. But he had something that was so remarkably wonderful. He had a magnificent smile and clear eyes. And I thought, boy, if we could just fill up the city with people like that, everything would work just fine. But we seem to have lost track of that. And those of us in the city don't have that kind of work anymore. Can you put him to work?
Yeah, I mean, we not only abdicated responsibility, but we also, abdicated hard work. Our daughter has been raised on a farm, since the very beginning, and I remember her seeing her first animal slaughter when she was 18 months old. We slaughtered a lamb on the farm, and she watched it with fascination, more like it was a biology class than fear. And now whenever we process an animal on farm, she invites her friends over to come watch. And luckily we live in a rural place where kids aren't skittish about those things. Not only do they watch, but they also help. She helps with the sausage making, putting together the spices and running the meat grinder. And I just think it's so important to, even if you're a vegetarian, to be involved in your food, to be involved in your food system, to understand, the land where it comes from, the people who are involved in it, and, to put some work and effort into it. It's incredibly rewarding.
Can it be rewarding to tend 1,000 acres of soybeans?
I mean, I'm sure a soybean farmer is really happy and proud after they complete their harvest. I'm sure there's a lot of elation there. But it's not the same as raising animals and being involved with them on a daily basis.
Rebecca Thistlethwaite, the author of The New Livestock Farmer. Is this really possible, Rebecca, for us to have small farms with real animals and reacquire the dominion over our animals?
I strongly believe it. Yeah, I mean, our farm was very profitable in California. The only reason we left was
we're out of time. I just caught the clock here. Rebecca Thistlethwaite, thank you so much, and we'll have to file this one under Michael Olson's second law of the food chain: the farther you go from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in your food. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.